Attended at the University of Virginia School of Nursing. Her dissertation is a mixed method study of food environments in rural Appalachia. She worked as a nurse in community hospital and primary care settings before entering the PhD program. Esther previously earned a bachelor's degree in rural sociology from University of Wisconsin at Madison. Esther.
My goal in this study was to identify strengths and challenges in the lives of lower-income Appalachian women that influence their food choices. And I have no relationship to this close. And this was part of my dissertation research, as you said. I'm thankful for the funding I received through the NINR, the Appalachian Prosperity Project, and the Healthy Appalachia Institute. So as we already heard from Dr. Hardin Fanning, the subregion of Central Appalachia, including parts of Virginia, West Virginia, Kentucky, Tennessee, and Ohio, have especially high concentrations of obesity, other health disparities, and economic disadvantage. Despite the widespread health disparities in Appalachia, few studies, up until quite recently, have assessed food choice factors in this population. Studies in other rural areas, such as Texas and Maine, have found various cultural, economic, and geographic dynamics that influence food choice. However, Appalachia has unique conditions that make a study worthwhile. This study took place in Lee County, that circled there, located in the far southwestern corner of Virginia. In key demographics, Lee County is much more representative of Central Appalachia than of Virginia. It is sparsely populated, mostly white, and many adults did not complete high school. The per capita income is half of the average for Virginia. Lee County is near the bottom for county health rankings in Virginia for all major factors. And this front page of a regional newspaper reviewed the county's losses in the past year. Its only hospital and car dealership and three elementary schools all closed. Coal mining has long been a declining source of jobs, as we heard about earlier, and there is an out-migration of younger people, especially those with higher education levels. This study used a focused ethnography approach. Like traditional ethnographies, the goal is to understand norms, behaviors, and values and social arrangements of a group of people with similar cultures. Focused ethnographies gather data more through interviews rather than extensive field observations. Interviews took place over three sessions held at least 1 week apart. The first included questionnaires about household resources, where they shopped, and food security. The second was a go-along interview while they shopped for groceries. And the third was semi-structured with prompts about experiences about food and feeding their families. Qualitative analysis followed conventional content analysis methods featuring inductive category production based on observations of study participants. Over 100 codes were created and then grouped into themes. A convenient sample of 9 lower-income women was recruited through WIC clinics, Head Start, and food banks. They were all white race, were between 25 and 60 years old, and ranged in education level from less than high school diploma to college graduate. 6 were not employed. 7 lived with their husband or partner, and there were between 1 and 6 children in their households. 1 had no household access to a vehicle. Data were organized into themes. Personal included knowledge and beliefs about food. Family included child rearing and social interactions. Household material resources included finances, housing conditions, and raising one's own food. Household food patterns encompassed storage, preparation, and serving of foods. Organizational behavior referred to planning and completing food acquisition activities. Store selection, specific food selection, and maximizing food value all focused on interactions with the retail food environment. Community included social support systems, community resources, and culture. Policy included comments about power structures and institutions beyond the community. The next slide will describe specific findings that help illustrate some of these themes with participant quotes in italics. All participants mentioned their mothers and other female relatives as important sources of knowledge about cooking and food. 7 had grown up helping a lot in the kitchen. Some had even been the primary cook from an early age. The 2 women who reported little experience while growing up showed a lack of knowledge and skills in food management. Home economics classes were not specifically asked about, and few participants volunteered that they learned about cooking from a home economics class. During their adult lives, several participants talked about continuing to learn about cooking, food, and nutrition. Common sources included jobs and childcare, volunteering, cooking classes, internet or smartphone apps, TV documentaries, and other mass media. Of four participants who were asked, all denied having received any significant education from a pediatrician or nurse. This was somewhat surprising given that five participants were currently enrolled in WIC, a program that includes multiple nutrition education sessions. All the participants were able to define healthy eating through lists of healthy foods. Several participants added the caveat that they couldn't afford to eat many of these foods, or at least chose not to. Some described limiting unhealthy foods, such as excess fat, salt, and sugar. Moderation in quantity was the component of healthy eating for several women concerned about their weight. Most participants with older children described active steps to train them on household and cooking skills. Throughout the interviews, traditional gender roles were prevalent. The two participants who had not learned to cook from their mothers had other characteristics in common, even though they varied in age, marital status, length of residency in the county, and housing security. Their attitudes towards feeding their children leaned towards permissiveness, allowing children to frequently eat fast food or to pick up multiple items in the grocery store, including candy. They did not have specific plans to teach their children about cooking or food. One said she wanted her kids to grow up being willing to try new foods. The other said she hoped her daughters would learn to cook, but her view on teaching them was, these here, I try to learn them stuff, and when I want them to do something, they don't want to do it. And then when they decide they want to do it, then they will. According to a study by Hennessy, permissive parental feeding styles is associated with higher consumption of low-nutrient foods and childhood overweight. The origins of this trait, as well as related behaviors that impact the health and development of children, bears further investigation. Six participants had experienced at least low food security during the last year, meaning they had enough food but reduced quality or variety. Four of the six said this did not affect how they fed their children. Only one participant had actually skipped a meal or reduced her food intake due to lack of money. Three participants went monthly to a food bank, and three others had gone at least once. Two participants had themselves experienced food insecurity as children. One described how she still felt compelled to keep large stocks of food at home just in case. So even a remote history of food insecurity may play a role in food shopping and preparation. Gardening and home-produced meat were important food sources for four of the women. They ate fresh produce in the summer and had canned and frozen produce in other seasons. Five ate deer meat or locally slaughtered meat. The key to raising crops was cooperative labor. Nobody did a garden on their own. They all worked with extended family members. Often the younger adults depended on older generations for skills like canning and seed saving. The support of a strong family network in this context was striking when contrasted with participants who lacked this. Two young mothers were both seeking similar jobs. One had lots of family nearby and plenty of homegrown food and meat. The other was new to the county with little social support and had little access to homegrown food. She described a high level of stress in providing enough of the types of foods that she wanted to feed her family through the month and had very few people to turn to for help. Another participant had unstable housing that made keeping a garden impossible, even if she had had the skills to do so, because she was unlikely to stay in the home long and had very little household equipment. I later interviewed a healthcare professional in a small impoverished town who said that many residents had unstable housing along with a lack of transportation. This created a double burden on their food security, being unable to grow food or get to a grocery store. Most participants took pride in making meals for their families on a nearly daily basis and appreciated the control they had over their food, over how their family's food was prepared. Some planned for occasional easy meals, such as fish sticks and French fries, that were treats for their family but less expensive than eating fast food. The two women who had not learned much cooking as children exhibited continued struggles with cooking from scratch. Though neither was employed outside their home, they stated it took too much time to cook vegetables, casseroles, and other dishes. One did enjoy making biscuits from scratch and also used a crock pot. Eating out, even fast food, was infrequent for most of the participants. All bought most of their household food from supermarkets and grocery stores. Those with SNAP benefits bought most of their food towards the beginning of the month and tended to run out of fresh produce before the month was out. The participants maximized food value through unique balances of price, brand, quality, convenience, family preference, and healthfulness. Those with large families or restrictive budgets favored large size packs of meat, priced lower per pound than smaller packs. Having an extra freezer at home was essential for storing these large purchases. Most said that fresh fruits and vegetables were expensive, and some were only willing to buy produce if it was very high quality. Canned or frozen vegetables and fruit were standbys, and in some cases preferred over fresh produce. Even the least educated participants had well-developed systems to know prices in different stores and to organize coupons to maximize spending power. However, most avoided travel to multiple stores because of the extra cost of gas. Most of the participants spoke explicitly about roles in taking care of people beyond their immediate families. Three of the families had long-term foster children or adopted children. Two of the most economically disadvantaged women still looked for ways to give, with one aspiring to become a foster parent and the other wiring money to a friend in worse distress than she was. Several participants were active volunteers in their churches and food banks and saw this as part of their religious faith. Traditional local foods included fried chicken, soup beans and cornbread, biscuits, sweet tea, and cooked greens. Some participants who were newcomers to the county felt pressure to master these recipes and to adapt their cooking to local styles. Kinship networks were also very important to establishing oneself as a newcomer. One newcomer described church dinners as having many unwritten rules about foods. Everyone had a specialty food, and she was expected to bring hers every time and not to change the recipe. Overall, there was strong agreement that those with economic or political power in the community had an advantage in maintaining the status quo. There are unique assets and challenges for eating healthfully in rural Appalachia. One's family background can have important impacts on their skills in managing food, and their social connectivity may affect their access to homegrown foods and other resource supports. The racially homogenous native-born residents had little exposure to diverse or new foods. While convenience and processed foods were commonly used, there were also strong connections to local food traditions that evoke great pride and promote skillful home cooking. This study's open exploration of Appalachian women's food choice experiences provides needed context for future studies of Appalachian health. Limitations included the small sample size and also the possibility of the bias towards social desirable answers. I'm going to skip straight to some modest recommendations for interventions to improve rural food environments based on this study. Further research should be done to determine whether these interventions might improve access to healthy food in low-income communities. Investing in community kitchens, cooking classes, gardening clubs, and local meat processing facilities could become a springboard not only for improved home cooking, but also for entrepreneurship to bring jobs and revenue to the area. Community gardens and farmers markets may also provide needed opportunities for disadvantaged rural residents to improve their access to fresh fruits and vegetables. Additionally, food banks may increase food security by seeking donations of fresh produce, meat, and other perishables, especially in the weeks when SNAP recipients tend to run low. There may be a tendency in rural communities to resist change when only a few people hold power. On the other hand, the small size of the community made it possible for very small groups of people to make a significant difference. This tendency towards grassroots action can inform future intervention design. Capacity-building interventions for rural residents who care deeply about their communities could increase the number of individuals willing to take on leadership roles. And finally, on a national scale, reinstating home economics or consumer science courses in K-12 education could ameliorate the learning gap of children who don't learn food skills at home. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We have plenty of time. If I could have the speakers back on the podium so that we can open the floor to questions. Yes, in the back, please.
Hi, this question is for Esther. Great presentation. So I have heard that with respect to gardening, garden, but I've heard that Appalachia actually has very poor soil and very rocky. Did that come up at all? Or is that a consideration for these women?
You know, when you look at the geologic regions of Appalachia and the mountains, some places are very rocky. This county happens to actually have a really nice, a wide valley that had traditionally been more conducive to agriculture, and so that wasn't as much of an issue as perhaps in other counties.
Yes.
I had a question about the mobile phone and intake inactivity. So just a commentary on one is, I think it's always interesting that when you start being aware and deliberate about looking at your food choices and your physical activity, there's a change, right? And I don't know if you saw that. If you saw, you know, on a time, and I apologize if you mentioned that and I missed it. And then I wondered also, as far as the racism, if there's a baseline that you start at that differs maybe with someone who is white. And what I'm thinking about that baseline is that it's the issue of being of color, not something that suddenly happens. You are that every day. You are that when you go into the store. You are that when you get on the bus. You know what I'm saying? It's just, I think maybe a racism that we don't take into account as far as looking then at food choices and how we deal with that perceived racism. Or maybe not subconscious racism.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks for those questions. In terms of the behavior change, yeah, absolutely, that's entirely possible. But I think if that was a problem, we probably would have seen less reports of snack food intake and probably more physical activity than what we saw. So, I mean, I agree that's a potential problem with the approach. But I don't know. We did ask a variety of questions in terms of feasibility, and one of the questions we asked was, to what extent did this change your behavior? And they really reported low levels of that. They had no reason to say, no, it didn't. I mean, so we did try to get at that. It didn't seem to be a problem, but it very well could be. In terms of your second question, I think it's a really good point. You might think of unfair treatment or discrimination being more of a chronic stressor, perhaps, that maybe it doesn't work well to assess in this kind of a momentary situation. So that's, I guess, one response to that. Did that answer your question?
I'm just wondering if there could be a comparison, and this may be totally off the wall, but looking at, you know, what is the stress level of someone to start with, right, at baseline? What are you starting with, rather than assuming that on a daily basis it ebbs and flows? Is there a certain point where your baseline will rate higher than someone else's? Basically, just based on, it could be their socioeconomic status, but also the race.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think we probably have to have a comparison group in whites, and I think that would be definitely something that we'd be interested in doing to really understand that. But I think there's complex interactions between chronic stress and then these momentary fluctuations in stress, and they're integrally tied, but also the chronic stress can exasperate things that happen, making the effects of those small things even worse. So I think there's really complicated and interesting interactions between the two. So, yeah.
It's another question.
Yeah, two questions for Dr. Harden Panning. What was your definition of grocery store? So, for instance, were Walmart included in your grocery?
No, we specifically, it had to be a retail grocery store that was either a regional or a national chain. It couldn't be a mom and pop facility because we wanted to make it as equal and possible across all four of the counties.
On that note, I need to say in the relatively rural area where we live, Walmart is one of the largest grocery stores available.
And we did that because in the urban areas, that's the same situation, but in our rural areas, they're not. In fact, the Walmart's got a very, very small section where they have sodas, Little Debbie's, potato chips, things like that. And you don't have access to a wide range of variety of foods in those Walmarts. That's a good question.
Other questions? Yes, please.
Karen, were there any trends or interesting things
difference between public health nursing in Minnesota versus any of the other states or some of the states?
Well, our N for non-Minnesota states were so small that we didn't really try to discover
anything.
It was very exciting to see the response from public health nurses all over the U.S. who were very interested in the study and wanted to support our work.
Yes.
Karen. So your results are very similar to the results. I mean, they're consistent with the enumeration study of public health nurses, and with a focus more on individuals and less on community, but some on community and systems. So I think looking for that kind of consistency is a good thing, and somebody should be sort of writing about that or putting all that together. The other thing is that your communication related to community resources, I think, is closely aligned with linking people to services, which Betty Beck and I talked about as one of the most important things that public health nurses do. So again, and I think Barbara Polika, I don't know if she's here, but she and the work that she reported yesterday talked about a similar thing emerging from her study. So I think, you know, there's some synergy in the findings that is valuable, and somebody should begin to try to put some of that together.
Yes, Pam, I agree. It's so consistent, but what you know, you don't have to do a lot of system and community level interventions to have a big impact. So the fact that we say we do so much more of the individual level doesn't necessarily mean that that's the same, you know, that the impact of those two levels is different. So I think it's really exciting, and thank you for pointing out the consistency across all these different studies.
And then, Shannon, could I ask, would you situate your study in a theoretical sort of base? Where would you situate it?
I guess I think of it in terms of an ecological model, so we try to assess factors at multiple levels. But, yeah, I think in general, there's not a lot of traditional health behavior theories, I think, that really fit well into thinking about the broad, complex things besides more of an ecological theory. So I'd be interested if you have thoughts about that.
I would offer that conversations about things like the Eisenfischline theory of planned behavior, and what you're dealing with is the space between intention and the behavior. And I've been involved in lots of conversations where we really don't know what it is that goes on between the intention to act and then the actual behavior, and that you could talk about it in that context, and it would sort of be a contribution to that sort of traditional health behavior theory piece. Mm-hmm. And then I know that there's a document that talks about 8 variables that are really important to change health behavior, and intention and no environmental constraints and ability to act are the key things, but the things you're dealing with, emotion and affective response, are also really important factors. So I guess, you know, this is pilot work and preliminary, but I'd love to see this, you know, just brought down to this level of having been situated in something broader, so that we can make the connection to the theory bases out there and help to inform our research more generally.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
Other questions?
I'm curious about the source of the 8 interventions.
They're the key constructs or key concepts.
Do you have a reference?
Yeah, I do. It came out of the NIMH workshop on theoretical foundations related to health behavior change back in the 90s, in the early 90s, and it's been published in 2001 or 2002 in a health behavior handbook, like the psychology of health behavior. But I could make that reference available to you. But they kind of take the variables from all the health behavior models and say these 8 are sort of common.
And has that particular reference that asked them before, and no one's been able to direct me to where it is. So I'm writing over it.
I actually have a copy of the original and then a copy of the subsequent publication. conversation that came out, but and it was Fishline, Becker. There were just these theorists were involved in sort of making this document and making this paper. So it's kind of useful for people who are interested in it.
Other questions? Yes.
I enjoyed your interesting comment about addictive foods. Can you just talk a little bit more with it in regard to high fructose corn syrup? Or
I'm not really sure about the mechanism of it, but I'm sure it's related to cortisol release, glucose levels, etc.
Any other questions? Well, let's give another round of applause to our excellent presenters.